meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news. Broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at ScaredMonkeysRadio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
And good evening, everyone. If you've been paying attention to the news lately, you'll see that the JonBenet Ramsey case has come forward again. If you listen to my daily commentary today, you'll see that I have some questions. And I thought I'd go to one of the experts that have been following this case pretty much from day one, Dr. Clint Van Zandt. Of course, you know Clint as a former FBI agent, hostage negotiator, profiler, someone who understands this case, to see what he had to say and see if he and I are on the same page. Here's Clint. Okay, we're back. If you've been following the news, you'll see that there has been breaking news, if you want to call it that, in the JonBenet Ramsey case. If you listen to my daily commentary today, you'll see that I don't consider it to be all that breaking of news. In fact, I compared the Boulder DA's office and John Mark Carr as both people who love to go in front of the media with information that really isn't all that important. Now, am I wrong or am I right? I thought I'd bring on someone who's very close to the case and has some knowledge of that. Clint Van Zandt. Hi, Clint.
Hey, Dana. Good evening.
Now, when I say that John Mark Carr and the Boulder DA's office are very similar, I'm in jest a little bit.
Sure.
But I'm also saying that the Boulder DA's office have a tendency to come forward all of a sudden, boof, out of the blue with comments. Well, they came out with John Mark Carr, and now they're coming out with this DNA revelation. Why now, and what does it mean?
Well, you know, I was on the Today Show yesterday morning here in the States talking about this, and, you know, John Mark Carr, if I can engage in a little cycle babble, you know, I think this is a guy who has what some people would call an encapsulated delusional system. If you kind of think of the old Tootsie Roll Pop that kids ate, at least when I was a kid, you know, you had candy on the outside, and on the inside, once you got down to it, you got that Tootsie Roll that was there. Some people psychologically, on the outside, they can relatively hold it together, but when you get on the inside, many times there's this encapsulated delusional system. This one crazy idea that they may hold on to, where on the outside, otherwise they can kind of carry on their life. And I think that's the case with John Mark Carr. Most will remember this was the wacko suggested child molester by some that was in Thailand that had carried on a email engagement back and forth with a professor in Colorado, a college professor. Realize this college professor also was somebody who really wanted to prove the Ramseys innocent.
Right.
So in the exchange of emails back and forth with the college professor and other people, they either led him along or he just stumbled and painted himself in the corner, where Carr eventually suggested at least he was there when JonBenet Ramsey died. If not, you know, she died at his hands. Well, the Boulder DA's office, when this was presented to them, and Mary Lacey, bless her soul, I'm sure she's a nice lady, but, you know, she eventually approved, and some would suggest begrudgingly so, bringing Carr back from Thailand. Part of the reason was, of course, that the investigators were over there. They figured that some suggested that Carr was starting to approach some children in a very negative manner, and they wanted to stop that approach. So they were going to use bringing him back to the States to potentially save these children. Nice idea, but the bottom line is, as I, you know, when the Carr story broke, I was up in New Hampshire someplace, and I got a call from NBC saying, "Where are you? We got to get you on television right away. JonBenet Ramsey's killer has just been arrested."
Right.
Well, I said, wait a minute, stop. You know, tell me who you got and what the story is. So they tell me about Carr, and I said, no way. I said, this is somebody who's looking for 15 minutes of fame. I said, show me John Mark Carr has ever been in Boulder, Colorado prior to the death of JonBenet Ramsey. Show me that he knew who JonBenet Ramsey was. Show me a credit card that says he stayed in a hotel in Boulder, Colorado. and I'll go for it. But I said, if I don't see anything like that, and if I don't see any DNA that links him to the crime scene or fingerprints or anything else, this is just one more guy who's raised their hand trying to get some attention. And in Carr's case, you know, of course, they could have conducted that investigation and shown that he'd never been in Boulder. They could have allegedly attempted to get a DNA swab. First he said he would, then he said he wouldn't, then he said he would, then he said he wouldn't, to get a DNA swab. Well, you, Dana, you and I know, if I give you a styrofoam cup to drink out of and you throw the cup in a waste can, if I get that cup, I've got your DNA.
Yeah, well, absolutely.
There's a lot of ways they could have gotten his DNA. So they dragged Carr back, dragging first class airfare back to the United States, and of course that whole thing then falls apart. Well, you and I remember back, Dana, at that time, I mean, the Ramseys were, and everybody connected with the case who were supporters of Ramseys were saying, look, look, you crazy people across the country, how could you ever accuse this family? Here's the killer. Well, of course, that whole thing fell apart in about a week and a half, and, you know, we were left back in the position again of who killed JonBenet Ramsey and who could have got in the house the night of December 25th, December 26th. 1999 to have done something like that. And the best they had at that time was DNA from her underwear that was allegedly mixed with some vaginal fluid or blood, probably from where a paintbrush had been inserted into her vaginal canal. And that blood had mixed with a piece or a spot or a flake of male DNA. Well, Henry Lee, the noted forensics person, went out and bought a brand new set of underwear, just like JonBenet had, and he found unidentified male DNA, suggesting a transfer from either packaging or manufacturing, which kind of threw that DNA out at that time.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you're just tuning in, Clint Van Zandt is here. And Clint, you know, as an investigator, profiler, as someone who's been involved in law enforcement for as long as you have been, you know, and I know that an investigation is many, many, many different pieces. The rush to judgment with John Mark Carr, and now all of a sudden this DNA revelation, and the Boulder DA's office coming forward to the Ramsey family basically saying, geez, we're sorry, this clears you, makes most investigators, I believe, and I can't speak for them, but I can speak for myself, sit back and scratch their head a little bit, because there's a lot of other evidence involved in this case.
Well, there is. You know, I mean, you and I could sit here, and we know some of this. There's both evidence, and there's both urban legend. Some
right.
people would say, well, what about that mysterious footprint that was left in the snow that night outside of a broken window that led into the basement? Number one, the window had already been broken, had been broken for months. Number two, the Ramseys never turned the alarm system on in their house. And number three, there is no investigator who was involved in the case that ever saw that footprint. So that kind of was smoke and mirrors that came out of nowhere. Then there is the ransom note. I mean, I looked at the ransom note originally for either, I forget, it was Time or Newsweek magazine that brought it to me as soon as it was released. I had already left the FBI. And when I looked at the ransom note, I said, you know, number one, this is a fake. It's a fraud. It's a red herring. JonBenet Ramsey was likely dead at the time this thing was written. And as you remember, Dana, somebody started to write the note and then wadded it up and threw it away inside the house using a pen and paper from inside the house, and then wrote a three-page alleged ransom kidnap note, the longest the FBI has ever seen as far as I know, inside the house and left it there at the time. Well, you read this, you know, we are a small foreign faction, you know. What is that? You know, these guys work for VW or something like that?
Right.
So there were so many things in there, and you could see where someone was trying to move their hand to disguise their handwriting, but as the letter goes on, the handwriting becomes much clearer. Well, everything in there is a fraud, a fake, as far as I'm concerned, and I think the letter was written after the death of JonBenet to help disguise the death, to make it look like it had been a kidnapping when in fact it had been something else. Well, my profile, for example, I said whoever wrote this letter was probably a white female, probably in her late 30s or her early 40s. She knows the Ramsey family. Obviously, she knows their finances, because a $118,000 ransom was the bonus that John Ramsey had just gotten that year. Who would know those intimate details concerning the family. So when I developed my profile, and people would say, well, you're talking about Patsy Ramsey. And I said, no, I'm not. I said, profiles don't tell you who. We just tell you the type of person that would have done it.
Yep.
But then handwriting experts came forward. I remember one handwriting expert said he had found 51 points of comparison between the handwriting of Patsy Ramsey and the handwriting on the ransom note. But again, there was another wacko handwriting expert who said he was 99.9% sure that John Mark Carr had written it, and we know that's fake too.
Yeah.
But Dana, there are so many items of behavior with the Ramsey family. Within five days of that little girl's death, they already had a lawyer and a publicist and their own private investigators. They made the police wait 4 months before they would allow themselves, husband and wife, John and Patsy, they made the police wait 4 months before they would sit down on a formal interview. They made the police wait almost a year and a half for the second follow-up interview and for an interview of their son, Burke, at the time. Well, they could do what they wanted to, but that's not the behavior that you and I normally see of someone who's trying to solve the murder of their child.
Yeah, absolutely. And one thing, just before we switch topics, Clint, that we can say is that this case is far from over, and it also brings out a big light as far as DNA analysis and the DNA data bank, and I want to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, well, as you and your listeners know, this new DNA is touch DNA. By and large, this is, and the investigators are right in what they did. They got the leggings that JonBenet Ramsey had the night she was killed, and they said, okay, the leggings had allegedly been taken off of her and then put back on her at the time of her murder. So how would somebody take these off? Well, you know, you and I, if it was one of our children we were putting to bed, we would grab either side at the waist, but at the far side of the waist, pull it down and then put it back on, whether you're dressing a child or what. So they scraped that and they found, you know, one or two microscopic, invisible deposits of DNA from where someone had allegedly touched that. And that DNA, now we're told, is a match to the unidentified DNA that was found mixed with blood or vaginal fluid in the underpants of the little girl. Well, I mean, that means something. That says that DNA was there. But how did that get there, Dana? Was that simply transfer? Could that unidentified DNA somehow from the leggings been transferred to the underwear because of the way they were folded in the evidence bag, or vice versa? I mean, the answer is we just don't know the significance of that DNA. Now, had it been John Ramsey's or Patsy Ramsey's DNA, that would have been explainable. I mean, they dressed their daughter before she goes to bed.
Sure, yep.
It wouldn't have been a big deal. Right now, the deal is we have unidentified DNA. We need to find out who it belongs to. But as the Boulder chief of police said within the last couple of days, this doesn't in and of itself exonerate anyone. In fact, it raises more questions than it does answers. So I think the Boulder DA was premature issuing a letter to the Ramsey family saying that they were no longer considered suspects, that they're considered victims. I'm sorry for their loss, and I will always be sorry for their loss, but as an investigator, you know, unless I can put them out of state at the time that child was killed, I still have to consider them potential suspects until I can rule them out. And this DNA, in and of itself, doesn't rule out anyone. And as you know, your lead question was, how can we match this? Well, the FBI maintains the National DNA Data Bank, but Dana, that only has 5.5 million samples in it, whereas,
exactly. Let's
say the fingerprint section has the fingerprints of 80 million different people in it. So 5.5 million is a very, basically, you know, 305 million Americans. That's a very small percentage to be able to check against. And until this country gets to the point where we say, if I as a law enforcement officer can take your fingerprints at the time of the arrest, I ought to be able to take a cheek swab and send that to the National Data Bank. And just like your fingerprints go to the FBI, your DNA should, and that standard should be there. Until we get to that point in this country where we do that, we're going to have mysteries like the JonBenet Ramsey case where we have unidentified DNA, and now we're at the point of sitting, waiting, hoping whoever this DNA belongs to maybe will wind up getting arrested sometime for a sex crime, which is the basis that many states use to take DNA, and eventually that DNA will be matched up. That's a long stretch when you say 5.5 million versus, you know, 305 million.
Absolutely, and I agree with you and agree with the Boulder police chief. This case is far from over. One thing I'd like you to comment on, Clint, just before I let you go, of course, speaking of cases in history, of course, we all know about the Zodiac Killer. Now we have a poor Army specialist that loses her life in a staged, in my opinion, bathtub murder, and we have Zodiac back, or do we?
Yeah, I think it's do we. As you know, the case you're talking about is a Army specialist by the name of Megan Truma.
Yes.
She had just returned to the United States. She'd been in Europe the last couple of years. She's about 6-7 months pregnant at the time.
Yeah.
So she comes back, and instead of living on base at Fort Bragg, she elects to live in a motel room just off the fort. The reason she came back is because her boyfriend / fiance / we assume the person who impregnated her is also in the military and is also assigned to that base. Well, she comes back and her body is subsequently found days and days later in the bathtub of the motel room that she was staying in, and she's dead. She's been murdered. Cause of death was something police was still working on.
Yep.
But they found blood splattered inside the apartment. So, you know, they have an idea. Obviously, it was a homicide. Well, you know, part of this rings like the case of Drew Peterson,
yep,
the police sergeant up north of Chicago, whose wife allegedly died in a bathtub, third wife, and now we know that was a homicide. So when I look at this case, the police come in and they find someone had used lipstick and had written on the wall or a mirror in this motel room the sign of the Zodiac.
Yep.
Well, this takes us, of course, back to the California Zodiac, and one wonders, you know, is this the Zodiac coming back again? And I would suggest that the way she was killed, her body left in a bathtub, something like, you know, Kathleen Savio, Drew Peterson's third wife, and the use of these Zodiac symbols, which, you know, go back to somewhere between 1963 and 1970, this is somebody who's read too many true crime books.
Yep.
And who was probably, what we're probably going to find out is this young woman was murdered by somebody very close to her, who knew she was back in town, who knew she was living off base, who knew she was living in the hotel, who knew she was pregnant and going to have a baby, and who would perhaps not want to see her live, perhaps not want that responsibility, but again, like in the JonBenet Ramsey case, try to point the authorities in some other direction by use of a red herring, in this case the Zodiac sign and symbol. That's what the police are dealing with now.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, as someone who's either been reading too many books or watching too many movies, but nevertheless, yeah. Interesting. One last question before I let you go, Clint. It seems like there's a never-ending cycle of these types of high-profile cases. You cover them, I cover them, and we continue covering them. But does the media, and I go back to JonBenet Ramsey, they jumped on that story real quick,
sure,
that exonerated the family. Is the media doing a good job, or are they rushing to judgment?
Well, you know, there's a new movie out here. It's the Get Smart, the Maxwell Smart
yeah,
movie. And in that movie, just like in the old TV series, Maxwell Smart always wants the cone of silence to come down so,
yep,
two people can talk and no one else can hear, and they can have that discussion. And, of course, the cone of silence never works in the movie. And as far as you and I and law enforcement investigators, we wish there was a cone of silence that would go over all of our investigations, that the media would just stay out and let us do our job. But again, you know, we learn, just like Maxwell Smart learns, that's not reality. So I think the balance is for the media to be able to report a case, but not over-glamorize it. Like JonBenet Ramsey, The same time she died, a little girl was murdered in the United States, happened to be African American. Her body was found in a closet. That case was never solved. Here we are, 12, 13 years later, we talk about JonBenet Ramsey. We don't talk about this other little girl, nor do we talk about the other 18,000 people who normally are murdered every year in the United States. So the media jumps onto a case that they think is going to have some high profile, it's going to have some media attention, and the honest news is that they're trying to sell airtime or newspapers or radio time or whatever it is. And it would be nice if they would just report what happened and then backed away. But instead, you have, you know, speculation by people with no law enforcement background, no investigative background, and they hit this thing, you know, like flies in the summertime on watermelon, and somehow we need that, you know, protective shield over both our watermelon and over our investigations. Dana, the reality is it isn't going to happen. The media is going to be there, and we're going to have to live with them. And all law enforcement can do is try to find ways to use that positively, to use the media to help get information out that will lead to the identification of a serial killer, a rapist, an arsonist, whoever it is, and hope that the media can police itself and not over-glamorize the case. Bad chance, right?
Right. Well said. Thank you, Clint.
Thanks for having me today.
Take care, buddy. Yep, bye-bye. Yeah. That's Dr. Clint Van Zandt. We'll be right back here on Scared Monkeys Radio. And I think all we have to do is just remember the high-profile nature of this case and that everyone, including the Ramsey family, does deserve answers, and hopefully the investigation will turn that way. My name's Dana Pritzer. This is the Scared Monkeys Radio Network. We'll be back in just a few minutes with Pat Brown. She's an investigative criminal profiler, and she has a story to tell you about anthrax. We'll be right back.
And now, more of the Dana Pritzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. Here's Dana.
Okay, we're back. Investigative criminal profiler Pat Brown is with us tonight. In fact, I think she's at a graduation ceremony. Hi, Pat.
Hey, Dana. How are you doing?
How are you doing? Did you finally graduate?
Well, I finally wore the robe. Let's put it that way. I graduated three times already, but never went to my graduation ceremony. So now that I'm a professor with Excelsior up in Albany, where I'm teaching criminal profiling and developing the first criminal profiling certificate program, I was asked to come up and attend the graduation and meet everybody there, and it was wonderful, and I got to see everyone graduate, and I got to wear the robe, so I think it's kind of funny. So I took a picture so I can give it to my mother.
Well, that's fantastic. That's just great. Listen, I brought you on tonight because one of the most high-profile type investigations that we heard right around the time of 9/11 and the whole war on terror, and there was the concern over weapons of mass destruction, chemicals, you name it, was the anthrax investigation, where the news media people, Tom Brokaw in particular, NBC, etc., were getting envelopes laced with anthrax. There was a big investigation, and all of a sudden we've heard nothing about it. But you were involved in this with your own profile of a suspect, and the FBI decided that they didn't want to even look at your information, or I should say didn't want to investigate your information. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, it was very strange, and I think we do not realize how often this happens. When we're looking at an investigation, we assume that the investigators involved are looking at every lead, they're tracking everything down, so we're going to be very safe because they're not going to let that stone be unturned. But actually what happens a lot of times in investigations is they get over-focused on one suspect because somebody thinks, that's a great suspect.
Yeah.
And he might be a good suspect. I'm not saying that Hatfield wasn't an interesting suspect. I would be looking at him. However, that doesn't mean you should never look at anybody else, because unless you proved Hatfield was the guy, you should be at least putting some efforts into other possibilities. And my possibility showed up one night because I'd done a profile on Fox, and I had given my belief of who this fellow was, and I said I believed he was out of Rutgers University in New Jersey, and I said I believe he's obsessed with the media. He's not a foreign terrorist. He's obsessed with the media. I think he's probably sent most of them letters to politicians and editors and got no response. And this is going to be his way of getting back at them to say, hey, you pay attention. And I think he's also obsessed with politics, and he thinks that we should protect ourselves in kind of a, you know, real kind of right wing in a sense, but, you know, in his own mind, not necessarily as attached to any group. but that he just thinks that, oh, we have to prove this. And, you know, it's a psychopath. So he's running this stuff in his head. And I believe he was a person who was going to be in the sciences, you know, would have access to this kind of thing. And I gave this profile, and I went home. And then a couple, few days later, I think 2 days in a row, I received letters that I picked up, and they were addressed to my organization. And I opened them up, and inside were some letters kind of raving strange stuff. They were all letters to the media, different sorts of media outlets, and going on about 9/11 and Osama bin Laden, and about different crimes and true crime here and there. It was all very weird stuff. And I said, well, that's strange. And then I turned the letters over, and the postmark was New Jersey. So I went, oh, my God. At least I go to the hospital.
Yeah.
But I didn't, because I felt stupid. But I did want to find out who wrote these letters. And I was able to track the letters down, indeed, to Rutgers, to a biology PhD at Rutgers. And this is what I brought to the attention of the FBI. I said, look, I got a fellow right after this profiling I did on Fox. He sent me these letters, which have a lot of similar concerning things in them to me. And the fellow is, I tracked him down. He had a phony address, he had a phony name, but I was able to track the letters down to Rutgers, to a biology PhD.
Right.
And he had mailed them out of the Princeton mailbox, the same one that went out of the anthrax letters. Now, he did not intend for me to ever track him down. It was not the intention of the letters. He did not give me his identity or his, you know, real location. He had a phony address and phony everything. But because of some of the choices he made, I was able to track it down. FBI just never bothered to deal with it. And I said, how can you ignore this fellow? And they just simply did.
Well, you know, and I think you make a very good point when it comes to investigations and blinders. You put a focus on someone like the individual Hatfield, and I don't know if it's arrogance or what it is when you do that. And yeah, maybe he should be looked at, but you have to keep a wider focus on other possibles. And when you start getting your own letters, it had to have been totally disheartening to see that the lead investigators, the FBI in this case, didn't want to do anything about it. Where did it go from there?
Yeah, it was very disturbing. And one of the things they told me when I showed them the letters and I told them where it came out of, their actual response was this, which made me laugh. I said, oh, he's just a nutter.
Yeah.
That's no joke.
Uh-huh.
And don't you think the fellow that sent these anthrax letters out is a nutcase psychopath?
Well, exactly.
I mean, we are looking for a nutter. Of course he is one. But it doesn't mean, I don't know if he's the nutcase that sent the letters or he's the nutcase that didn't send the letters. But the fact that there were like 10 connections that led to this particular person. He did exhibit psychopathic behavior. He had an obsession. He had an obsession with the government and politics and the media. He had all those obsessions. He had a connection to American media in Florida. And he wanted to be a government agent. That was his fantasy. And he said after 9/11 he was helicoptered down to do secret work with the government. This is a fellow who has access to, he was a biology PhD, he was in soil, where that was his work, and he had a girlfriend who was at Princeton, and they had connections to Duke. I mean, so I'm not saying that he did this, but the letters, I believe, came from this man, and he certainly was a concerning person that they should have been all over. Whether they would have ever proven he had anything to do with it, I don't know. And whether he did, I don't know. But goodness, I mean, this is somebody, if I were in their shoes, I'd be looking at. And which is why I went to them with a picture. And it was very sad to see that they pretty much ignored it.
Now, this is a story that we haven't heard much about in the news lately. In fact, I haven't heard anything for quite some time. Are you aware of the status of that anthrax investigation?
I'm sorry, I missed that. What was that?
This is a story that we haven't heard from in quite some time. I haven't been informed as far as any status of the investigation. Obviously, it's still open.
The investigation probably will do nothing, and this is what often happens. They have a suspect, it doesn't pan out, they ignore it, they drop it, and we just forget about it, quite frankly.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things they count on, too, is that after the initial fear is died down, oh, well. And if you think about it, how many cases recently have we heard about that we suddenly hear nothing about?
Yeah, exactly.
Do you remember the girl out in Reno who was a college girl who the guy went into her home and grabbed her and took her away and serial killer raped and murdered her?
Yep.
Have we heard anything about that since?
Nope, we haven't heard a thing.
How about those Oklahoma girls? Those Oklahoma girls that were shot, the two young girls?
Yeah, exactly.
Have you heard anything about that?
No, that's an excellent point, because the media seems to go from one case to the next. And I think
yes.
That goes to my next question, and you've already answered it, but when you are an investigative profiler, when you do media work like you do, and you don't just do total media work, there is this misconception that profilers are able to pinpoint that it was Joe Smith that did it, or it was Don Grant that did it, and you can't put a name to the person, or at least in most cases, am I correct, you can profile that person.
Well, that all depends. In certain circumstances, when I'm working with the police department, and I actually go to the police department, I'm presented with a case, and I look at the case, and there is a particular suspect that is somebody who is a known person. And I analyze the case and say, wait a minute, I absolutely know who did this.
Right.
It's so-and-so. Because you already have him. He's one of your, he's already on a list. In other words, maybe there's a suspect. He might have been considered a witness. He might have considered a family member. He might
sure.
have considered a weird guy down the street. But
yep.
everything's working, and that everything's matching that one guy. So, yes, sometimes you can pinpoint him. But other times, all you can do is say, it's some creepy guy who probably lives within a you know, 2 mile radius. I mean, you want to base everything on evidence. You don't want to make one of these phony profiles, which is just vague. Because it really, I mean, you could say that about a lot of people. I mean, when you have a strangled dead woman in the bushes who's been torn up, I mean, you can pretty much say you've got a psychopath. But, I mean, that's not rocket science. Pretty much anybody knows that. And so you could certainly tell generalities so that when you're a police officer, you make at least sure you're paying attention to the generalities. That doesn't hurt. Because oddly enough, sometimes people don't pay attention to generalities either. For example, a lot of times people don't even know what a psychopath acts like. They say, oh, he's a psycho. You know, he's a psychotic. No, he's not a psychotic. Psychopath. The difference between the two of them. So that's important to know. So you can tell generalities in some cases, but if you know, really the purpose is to analyze the evidence and narrow things down so the police can not waste so much time.
After your profile and receiving these letters yourself, did you ever receive any more correspondence from this person?
No. In the Anthrax case, I received two letters, and then I investigated it, and I left it in the FBI's hands. All I wanted to do was find out if there was, you know, who was sending this, and was there a reason to turn it over to the FBI? And the answer was yes, but they never did investigate it, so they just let it drop. And I figured I can't involve myself in it at a certain point. I don't, you know, it's their investigation.
I think it's fascinating when you talk about narrowing the focus here most recently with the JonBenet Ramsey case, and I just finished up an interview with Clint Van Zandt on this, where the Boulder DA's office, when they heard about John Mark Carr, jumped on him like a bird on a bug and were very embarrassed after that was all done. Now we see that there's some DNA evidence that's come out, and the Boulder DA's office again was quick to run to the media and say, well, this DA or this DNA evidence now clears the family. Are investigators, DA's offices, FBI, whoever, too quick to run to the media to try and, I guess, justify what they're doing when they really don't know the big picture?
I would say that there's a lot of politics involved, and unfortunately, it doesn't mean all investigators are involved in politics. There are many great police investigators who will doggedly do their duty, and they will try to, you know, ignore the politics from above or from beyond, or you know, the political stuff in the community, and I respect highly those officers who do that. And of course, there's other officers who have to succumb to some extent because they have to keep their jobs, and you can't blame them for that either. And the same is true for prosecutors and DAs and all that. So, I don't hold it against a lot of them for being struggling within the work that they do, within the politics that they have to. You know, it's just unfortunate. We all have politics in our lives. In particular, Lacey's case, I'm not quite sure what her issues are. I think she has been very quick to jump on things. I'm a little appalled that she completely cleared the Ramseys.
Yeah.
This DNA has been around for a long time. It's very extremely, extremely, extremely minor DNA. It doesn't necessarily prove anything. It's been often said that it might be an artifact, which means that it has nothing to do with the crime. It could have been something from a lab. It could have been something from God knows where. Could have even been just that, you know, JonBenet was rolling around with some young one of her, you know, little friends at a party, and something flew her direction. I mean, so minor. I mean, so terribly minor that it doesn't really prove anything. And one of the things what happens a lot of times is one person will grab out of this evidence, and then they will pick and choose other pieces of evidence that say, absolutely, this clears the Ramseys. I don't think it does. I think it was a tremendous amount of evidence that was very concerning, which made one look at the Ramseys very hard. I personally do not think anything has cleared the Ramses. I don't think anything has proven that they're guilty. But I certainly personally cannot take them out of the picture because an awful lot of things were peculiar in the case. That don't make a lot of sense.
I agree with that.
I think it's an open case, in my opinion.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think this case is still wide open. Just before I let you go, I think it's interesting that you are instructing a course on being a profiler. And my next question is pretty much wide open, but I'll ask you, what makes a good criminal profiler?
Excuse me?
What makes a good criminal profiler?
Well, I personally think it's a combination of things. First of all, logic is really helpful. I mean, you have to have a good logical mind, one that doesn't jump quickly to conclusions, and one that will doggedly try to figure stuff out. It's really analyzing more than anything else. It's combining forensic evidence, both the physical and the behavioral. You want to take a look at all the evidence that you've got and really see what will prove what exactly happened in that crime. And so you really want a person who wants to undo a puzzle more than anything else. That is the critical part in my program that I'm developing that is available through Excel here. And, you know, you can already go there. There's forensic pathology, but you must understand forensic pathology, the basics of what happens to the body, how it's, you know, what happens to when a person kills that person. And then there'll be courses on crime reconstruction, so that you can figure out what happened in the crime. Criminal profiling in general, so you understand all the ins and outs of criminal profiling. I do a course in serial homicide investigation, because a lot of criminal profiling is related to rape and serial homicide investigation. So that is extremely important as well. And of course, we have a course in psychology of violent crime, because let's face it, when we're talking about profiling, usually we're dealing with violent criminals and offenders like serial killers, and we don't have to understand their psychology and how they're going to behave with the victims and how the victims are going to behave. So we want to understand all the psychology around the crime for the behavioral part. So that's the kind of program that has never been in existence in America. Those five courses put together so you can have a well-rounded view of what you need to do when you're coming into a crime scene and trying to understand what happened to that crime scene.
Absolutely.
And, so we have it now.
Absolutely, and it's that whole big picture and being able to understand it. Pat Brown, it's always nice to have you on the show.
It's a pleasure, Dana.
Take care.
Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
That's investigative criminal profiler Pat Brown. And, you know, we seem to keep having these cases over and over and over again. And I find it disturbing that the FBI decided that they didn't want to investigate this anthrax case the way that Pat was looking at it. You need to look at all aspects of an investigation right from the top to the bottom, because you just never know. You just never know what may break open, and that includes the Ramsey case, which is far from over. My name's Dana Pretzer. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Scared Monkeys Radio. Once again, here's your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, we're back. And if you haven't already, make sure and go to the webpage at www.scaredmonkeysradio.com. There you'll be able to pick up the show live, listen to a podcast of shows that go back, I think there's a couple of years worth on there now, and of course the daily commentary. And you can leave comments, and well, you can do just about anything at scaredmonkeysradio.com. My next guest, Michael Bryant, was a correspondent on Court TV. And what we're missing now, I know there's this True TV and others, is we're missing that gavel-to-gavel courtroom coverage like we saw with O.J. Simpson and others, Rodney King, and the fascination that Mr. and Mrs. Public have with that. Well, Michael Bryant is going to do something about it. Of course, he worked with Court TV, and he and I sat down a little bit earlier today and talked about it. Okay, we're back. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. My name's Dana Pretzer. Many of you may remember Michael Bryant from his stint at Court TV. Michael's been a California attorney practicing for 15 years and a trial correspondent on Court TV. He had stints with Current Affair and Extra, and now he's working on something called the Legal Edge. It's the Legal Edge Network, and the launch of it is coming very near, and I thought I would bring Michael Bryant on the show to talk about that. Hello, sir.
Hello, Dana. Thank you for the opportunity. I appreciate that.
No problem. This is something that my audience and I are excited about. Tell the folks about the Legal Edge Network.
Yes, and I'm very excited as well. In fact, as I've said before, I've not been this excited since I hit puberty, so it's pretty big.
Okay.
Back in the day, the Legal Edge began as a series of consumer legal segments, which will be featured on the Legal Edge Network site. And it's really, they're 90-second vignettes about how to get through life and how the law affects virtually everything you do, whether it's getting kids a permission slip to go on a field trip or getting your landlord to give you your deposit back on a rental. I mean, everywhere you look, you're stepping in some sort of legal mess. And so we have nearly 1,000 of these segments that have been produced over the years, Emmy award-winning, I might add. And so they will populate the site. But the new, what should I call this, the growth of the Legal Edge in this particular case. And what we're talking about here specifically today is the fact that we will now add live streaming trial coverage to what we offer to folks in terms of consumer and legal information. So we are going to begin with the O.J. Simpson trial, that little O.J. Simpson trial out in Las Vegas. It'll be our first effort, but it certainly won't be the last. We will continue to program trials from across the country, kind of like Court TV used to do, not even in the recent past when I was there, but even before that, when you really got more trial, less talking heads, less commercial interruption, we won't have any of that. In fact, I think the web is really the better place for trial coverage for many reasons, one of which is you got the streaming video nonstop. It is true gavel-to-gavel coverage, and there's no way a commercial is going to get in the way because you just don't need to do that with the Internet. So we're very excited about bringing this, kind of reinventing the wheel on this.
Of course, the public's fascination with trial coverage started with O.J. Simpson, so to speak, but it goes back as far as the Lindbergh kidnapping. And there's that, sadly, there's all sorts of trials to choose from, everything from the weird to the wacky to the high-profile cases. But you understand, of course, being in the business that you've been in, that there's a craving for this, and I think you've hit the nail on the head as far as comparing the Internet to the mainstream media. Court TV went downhill when they started showing the series and the infomercials came on at night, and then it wasn't really Court TV anymore. That's not what your new undertaking is going to be about, correct?
No, it's going to be really a throwback to what it was like back then. I certainly understand Turner's desire to make a dollar. I mean, they were doing fine before. They were making a dollar. Now they want to make a dollar and 20 cents. And that's what makes the business world go around, and I understand that. But as Steve Brill, the founder of Court TV, said, and he was no longer connected with Court TV as of about 7-8 years after it had started, he said, when Court TV died, he said, nobody likes to see the end of a journalistic outlet. But what they have done at Turner is create a huge gap for somebody to step in and fill. And that's what we're going to do.
I just remind the listeners, if you go to thelegaledge.com, you'll see the start of something that's going to be really big. Michael, why does the public have such a fascination with this? Sometimes sitting through a court case has got to be the most boring. You can have 5 hours of boredom and 3 hours of, or 3 minutes of excitement when the sentence gets passed, but that's not really it. It's the public has this fascination with this type of coverage. Why do you think?
It's a sophisticated form of entertainment, really. In this short attention span theater that we now live in, it is difficult for folks to focus on something, as long as it might take for a trial to truly develop and then resolve. But the payoff is huge because this is real. I mean, it's Shakespearean. It's good guys and bad guys. It's evil like you would never anticipate in your own life. It is victimization like you hope to never experience in your own life. And people, it's not a vicarious thrill. It's the opposite. It's like, man, that could be me. I hope that's never me. And yet here's somebody going through a life experience that is not so far from possible in your own life. So I think there are many reasons people gravitate toward this stuff. The primary reason is very simple. Four-letter word, real.
Yeah, absolutely. If you're just joining us, Michael Bryant is here, and he's starting up something called thelegaledge.com. There is a book called The Legal Edge. Tell us about that.
Yeah, when I began doing the Legal Edge segments, now it's been about a dozen or so years ago, a publisher approached me and said, hey, this would be great to put into kind of capsule form in a book. And so the answer to their first question, which was, what's the most popular topic, was simple, and it's where you live. I don't care if it's an apartment, you're trying to do a home business, you're trying to sell your home. any of those things, anything revolving around where you live, by far the most popular topics with consumers. So the book is a culmination of my Q&A with real viewers from the TV show. People would write in, hey, legal edge guy, you know, I'm trying to start a business in my home, and my neighbor's upset about it. What can I do? And so I would cover through two avenues, really, what the options are. I would say, here's the law. Here's the hard and fast law. But now here's life. Here's how you can deal with the law. Here's how maybe you can work around it. Here's how maybe you can work with your neighbor before you get the courts involved. Because let's face it, you know, if you can't negotiate, you litigate. The key to getting around any legal problem is trying to resolve it without the court. You don't want to go to court. So the book is really just a collection of a number of issues that I dealt with on the TV show.
The media and trial attorneys, district attorneys, I've interviewed them all. Most recently, Joel Brodsky, who's representing Drew Peterson, he told me very plainly on this program that he likes to use the media as much as he can, because when this does go to trial, if it goes to trial with Mr. Peterson, that'll be a big high-profile case, and he wants the people to know all about that. And the DAs, they kind of want it to be quiet unless it's in their favor. You know as well as I do that the lawyers, the judiciary, love it. How about the judges? Do they like this being put on air?
Boy, you know, the answers are as varied as the judges themselves. Some like it too much, and I think we saw that with Judge Ito back at O.J.'s first trial, or first criminal trial anyway. And some just don't want to take the chance, because let's face it, they are front and center for everything happening in that courtroom, good and bad. And a lot of judges don't want to take the chance. Now, they may hide behind the argument that it really doesn't help the defendant, that it's too much pressure on the attorneys, and they act differently with the cameras. I think that's a lot of crap, actually. I think the judge is more concerned about covering his own ass, because that's what judges do. All through the course of a trial, their goal is to cover their backside, because appeal is an attack on what they've done. They want to make the record as clean and clear and safe for them as possible. It's the nature of the job. It's not a criticism of judges. That's what they have to do to stay judges. Nobody wants to be reversed on appeal. It doesn't look good. And I think when you're exposed to the cameras, to the media, to the public in a larger sense, you're increasing the odds you're going to look bad. And no judge wants to look bad.
You're starting out with O.J. What can the folks expect after that?
Boy, you know, there are a couple of high-profile cases on the horizon. You know, the Baby Grace case is early November in Texas. That's the Ziegler case. So that's not, you know, that's about a month after O.J. I figure O.J. will be to verdict by the end of September. Maybe sooner if he loses a couple of co-defendants that they roll on him, which is what I'm hearing from sources in Las Vegas, that they don't want to be tried with this guy. So if he ends up going solo, that will speed up the trial, that's for sure. There is a great case that I hope we get into and goes in February, the Alpha Dog murder. It's the Jesse James Hollywood murders out of Santa Barbara. And there's kind of a hit and miss chance of getting into court there. California is generally okay, but it is very much up to the judge. And that county is a little more conservative than some might. It's not Santa Maria, San Luis Obispo County, which is where Michael Jackson was tried. It's just south of that, but it's an outrageous trial. People might remember the name Alpha Dog because it was a movie that just came out maybe 4 or 5 months ago. I think Justin Timberlake was in it and a couple of other actual actors. So there's a lot of, in between these bigger trials, there's a lot of, you know, what you unfortunately call run-of-the-mill murders and, you know, spousal murders and girlfriends and boyfriends. But there's some car crashes, manslaughter cases. There's so much stuff going on out there. Unfortunate in general, fortunate if you're trying to cover these things, because we never run out of stuff to do.
Absolutely, and the public has a huge appetite for this. Now, the internet site again for my listeners is thelegaledge.com. When can we expect to see beta testing?
Yeah, well, we hope to get the beta version up by the 17th, 18th of July, and right now if you go to the site, thelegaledge.com, you'll get a chance to sign up for the newsletter, take a look at the past newsletters, which kind of track our progress over the last couple of months. A new video update actually will be on the site within hours of hearing our interview here. So it'll give you an idea of where we are with regard to the actual beta launch. What we expect to have on the beta won't be live streaming trial coverage, because that won't begin until September. But we have the chat feature, which a lot of folks are looking forward to.
I think we'll have the message boards up at that point. We will have some of these legal edge consumer segments. We will have also a huge library we have of caught on tape segments, which is everything from craziness in the courtroom to dash cam video to convenience store crime. And we'll have a sampling of that now. Each of these categories we are continually adding to, but we want just a sampling when we start, maybe 100 legal edge segments, 100 caught on tape, something like that. And those things will continue to grow. So we want people to go to the beta launch and give it a spin. You know, we know we're going to have mistakes and have problems. That's why it's beta. But we'll have 6 to 7 weeks before OJ to actually kind of get our act together. And we will only do that if we have the help of folks who are trying it out.
Absolutely. Sounds fantastic. Michael Bryant, thank you, sir.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And that's the LegalEdge.com, gavel-to-gavel coverage. We're all interested in that. We'll be right back here on Scared Monkeys Radio. Yeah, where would we be without some OJ coverage, and that's coming soon. Well, that's tonight's show. I hope you all enjoyed it. Again, our webpage is www.scaredmonkeysradio.com. There you can listen to the show live. This show will be archived and available a little bit later on this evening for replay. I thank you all, and we'll see you again real soon here on Scared Monkeys Radio.
Been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guests' websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.